Well, I think this is the news, according to me. And I think it is because yesterday I only had one show. Because by the time I got the morning show uploaded, it was already evening. By the time the evening had rolled around, I was so tired from uploading the first show. I literally went to bed last night at 9:30. I think I may have been in bed before JoJo last night. excuse me. I don't know. I don't know what's going on with this internet thing. I really wish I could find a way to do this show live, because it would be. And I'm not doing the YouTube thing, folks. I'm not doing it. I know I could go on YouTube live. I've done it before. It is absolutely ridiculous what's going on there now. I don't know if you heard this morning. I just heard this morning that Steven Crowder's been pretty much banned off of YouTube again. And they're not really, apparently it's over something that it's not just about factual stuff now. If you present facts that they don't like, they will ban you. This is the Ministry of Truth from Orwell in, you know, the book 1984. He just missed the timeline by about, you know, I don't know what, 35 years, whatever, 37. I can't do math. I was told there would be no math. To do a podcast, I was told I didn't have to do math. When I took this job, when I went through the process of being hired, the council, the committee, I went through a major HR, bunch of hoops I had to jump through to get this job. It took me over a year of interviews and resumes, you know, all kinds of things. They finally decided to, because they couldn't find anybody else, they just went ahead and hired me. And here I am. Yeah. If you believe that, they let me have the job on one criteria, basically one on the basis of one agreement. That is that I would not get paid for it. So there you go. That's how I got this job. I was the cheapest guy. In fact, they were actually having some offers. They were looking for offers of people who would pay them to do the show. And that didn't pan out for them very well. So here I am doing the show for you for free. Well, it's not free to me. Truth be told, you know, podcasts are not free. You have to pay to have a platform to post them on. So just so you know, this is coming to you sponsored by, the only sponsor there is me, yours truly. Only my passion for getting the truth out there, telling you about the news, and especially the biggest passion I have is letting you know what my opinion is about news. That's kind of funny. At least in my little world, it's funny. I'm laughing in my own head here, so I'm laughing at my own jokes. I'm in a rubber room telling jokes, and I'm laughing about it. I'm laughing at my own jokes, and this is why you pay so much money to see this show. And you can't even see it. All you can do is hear it. That's the beauty of it, because I have a face for radio, I've been told. Or maybe I have a voice for radio. Maybe that's what it was. The face, whatever. So yes, there's lots of, this is interesting. Apparently, Crowder has, he has, you know, a lawyer, obviously, he uses his lawyers, lawyers, I'm not sure what. He's got a pretty good lawyer, I think. I really like the guy. He's been on the show, you know, he usually has he's got a seat there for him. He's not always in it, because I'm sure he's busy, but there's a lot going on. I'm sure he's a busy guy. Of course, as I'm doing this and talking about my slow internet, I have Comcast now offering me a $35 deal, which is not a $35 deal. If you call the number, what you'll find out is it's $35 additional to the. They'll sell you a package, and the internet part of it is $35. It makes it look like, hey, if I have 35 bucks in my hand, I can just slap it down on the table and not have internet. No, it doesn't work that way. If you buy this $85 a month package for $35 more, you'll get internet. Oh, and do you want actually fast internet? Oh, that's going to cost you. Oh, you want it installed? Well, that's going to cost you 12 grand. That was literally, I kid you not, I am not stretching this. I called them. I said, hey, what would it cost to have internet installed in my office here? Well, looking at your past history, I think the last person that inquired was back in 2007, which would have been me. Apparently, I owned the building at that time. And I remember inquiring about it, and they said I was unable. They were unable to provide me service here at this location. Well, then stop sending me advertising. I get advertisements in the mail to take Comcast service here. Was unavailable at this location. So now they say, well, they don't know why they put down unavailable. It is available, and because they went back in the records and actually found that from 2007, the inquiry that I had made. It was at the end of 2007, right before the economy crashed. And now they say, well, it looks like based on knowledge that we have of the building, we have to give an estimate based on until we have a site survey done. We have to come out and look at the building. It looks like installation would cost about $12,000. Now, I want to know how much they're paying the guy who comes out here with a truck and runs a line off of a pole right here in the back in the alley, in the back of the building here, in the alley, runs a line 25 feet to my building, inside the building, and attaches it to a box, which he can do in about 3 hours, I'm sure, if he takes a break in the middle of there. He must be charging about $6,000 for that. They must be paying him a lot of money to do that. I would do it for $1,000. I would do two or three of them a day. Well, I don't know. I'm not so sure. Well, I don't know. That might require me wearing gloves and actually getting out in the cold and rain and actually doing work. Come to think of it, I probably wouldn't do it for that price. I would probably have to charge 12 grand to do that because I wouldn't do it for less than that. That just sounds like a lot of work. And I'd probably only do one a week, frankly. That's just too much. I might do like three a day for a month and then take the rest of the year off. That's how I would do that. Because then you're in the tax bracket that, you know, where it's just you work more and they don't make anything. I talked to an accountant one time, and I was kind of excited about the fact that I was starting to make more money. You know, that's kind of something to be excited about. And I was concerned because you hit to a certain point. There's a certain point where you hit the tax bracket, and it's quite significant, the amount of taxes you pay beyond a certain point. And it just keeps ramping up, which in my opinion is incredibly unfair. Most of my life I've worked very hard and made very little most of my life. Done a lot of volunteer work as well, but that pays really well. Got to tell you, that'll set you back. But you get to a point in your life where you finally have kind of a skill, a marketable skill, an ability. Something that you finally find that you can do that actually people pay you for and they're happy about it. You can pretty much name your price. It's getting a little bit concerning here now. Kind of looking around like the sky is going to fall. Like what's going on here? This is in some kind of a matrix. So now that that's happening, I want to make sure I don't. Because to make an additional, typically this is the way it works in business. If you're doing a good job, you're working hard, you've built up your business, and you get to this kind of a point where if I work a little bit harder, I can make X amount of dollars more. And then you kind of get this, it's kind of like an airplane flying through the sky or a boat going through the water. There's this law of physics where it requires, like let's say like a sailboat. A sailboat has a displacement hull or a semi-displacement hull. The hull is designed to go 7.2 knots through the water. That's its hull speed, where it is most efficient. It requires a lot of horsepower or power in the sails to go a certain speed through the water, or a trawler. This would be a better example. Would probably be a trawler, because it's flat and level water, going through the water. No wind, just going through the water. At say 8 knots is its hull speed. So at eight knots, you're burning the most efficient use of fuel for the longest distance at the highest speed you can go. There's a lot of things there I could say. I mean, if you slow it down a little bit, you're going to save a lot. But that's your most efficient speed, high speed that you can go. Now you can take the boat up to 10 knots, but for every knot, it will require almost a doubling of speed of power. And I'm probably offshooting that. The percentage of power that it requires to get you up an additional 2 knots is well over anything that's efficient or that makes any sense. Same thing in an airplane. If you're flying along, it's kind of designed to fly at 110 knots. Small airplane, small single-engine airplane. If you try to go faster than that in that airplane, it's going to require huge amounts of power to get just 5 knots more out of it. Because you hit this point of, I don't know what it's called. There's a technical name for it. I'm not going to even venture out into that realm because I'll get it wrong. I'll get all kinds of cards and letters and hate mail. At this point, I wouldn't care if I got any hate mail because I don't get any mail at all. So you have this issue here. So in my opinion, this is kind of what happens in the business world. You're working along, you're efficient, you're operating, you kind of naturally grow, you're organically growing to a certain point, and you're able to take that next step to grow a little faster, but a lot of times you have to work twice as hard just to make, 10 or 20% more in profit. It is not worth it. I kid you not. And then you get to that point, I've had a business where I started hiring people. I started hiring people so that I could be, I could grow more. So now I have people working for me. I had 8 people working for me at one time. Now some of them were part-time, some were full-time, but they were eight total people, probably a total of about, five and a half, probably to full-time positions. If you want to count the part-timers and the half, the full-timers. And at some point you realize now I'm not doing the thing I love to do that I want to do. Where my skills are, I'm managing people. I'm babysitting. I'm taking care of the business, but I'm not getting to do the very thing in the business that the business does that I really enjoy doing, that I'm really good at. The talent that brought me to this point, now I'm doing something else. And guess what? I'm making less money. I'm a bigger company. I have more employees, and now I'm making less than my employees. Now, I love the idea of providing jobs. I love that idea of hiring people, putting them to work, helping them in their career, doing whatever, whether it's a starter career, whether it's full-time career, making them, and just helping them to have a good life. I love that idea. But I learned early on, in my younger, more ambitious years, that is not always the best plan. Not because it's not a good thing to do. It's because the way the government wants to penalize you for doing such a thing. You end up spending a lot of money to have an employee there. And I'm not just talking about what goes out in actual payments to the employee sees a certain amount in the check. Say they make $100. I'm just I'm just saying, you know, that's, I wouldn't pay somebody $100 a week unless they were only working, you know, a day a week. Well, let's say, just for the sake of round numbers. Oh, let's say $1,000. That's more fair. Let's say I'm paying somebody $1,000 a week to work for me. Their paycheck at the end of the week is $1,000. Or at the end of the year, whatever, whichever one, you know, it's whatever. So they get their paycheck for $1,000. Out of that check comes certain deductions. There are, you know, there's federal, FICA, you got Social Security, all those things coming out of there. You got state tax, you know, county tax, sometimes city tax, other things, health insurance possibly. That's all. That's different though. So let's just go with the taxes that come out. On top of, in the federal part of it, I think it's 7.5% that the employee has taken out, depending on how many, you know, depending on their dependents and all that stuff. So let's say they have 7.5% taken out of their check. What's the little known secret here is that the employer is paying the other 7.5% because your employment tax or your federal tax is income tax is 15%. And what they don't tell you is that the employer pays the other 7.5%. So you only see half of it. Or is it the other? It's whatever the numbers are. Your employer is paying the other half of whatever it is. I could be way off on that. I'm not sure. I can't remember what it is. And maybe it's because it's probably changed a lot since I did, you know, this was back in the 90s. So whatever it is, your employee pays that. Your employer pays that. Now, the more employees that the employer has, the more time it takes to manage all this stuff. You know, just doing payroll. This is why people go to, you know, automated services and have other companies run their payroll. And they charge a premium for this kind of thing. And they can get it because otherwise I have a staff of people who are nothing but overhead taking care of administrative duties like payroll. And if every company has a payroll, you know, department, it starts to get kind of expensive. Because now you've got now you got more employees taking care of payroll. So you got to pay them. Instead of just paying a service to do it for you, and you just send all the information to them, they handle all the payroll. It's all automated. Nothing's in-house. You don't have to pay for desks and chairs and daycare and all the other crap that you got to pay for. Whatever it is you got to do, take care of all these people. And so that's why it's successful, because they're doing nothing but payroll, and they're doing it for 100 companies instead of just one. And it's all, you know, it's all automated, computerized. Everything's done properly. Of course, now you still have to have somebody enter all the data in, but that seriously reduces your load. Instead of having somebody basically almost full time or half of their job description is to do payroll, that becomes expensive. You know, in a lot of ways, and I think it's at some point, you know, you realize this. And I even knew a guy who had a machine shop who basically, he had employees for a while. He would keep hiring employees. He would have some like guys that he would intern sort of would come in, had several employees. He learned early on as well. Same thing happened to him. So it's not just, it's also, you know, kind of in the main, now he was not manufacturing his own products. He did start doing some of that a little bit. He had some inventions that he actually started manufacturing on his own. All of his work was outside work. People would bring him work to do with his machines. He had a lot of CNC, which is computer controlled equipment. He would, the milling and the lathe equipment, he would make parts for other people. So he wasn't really manufacturing anything. He was part of the manufacturing process, doing outside work for companies that were actually manufacturing and assembling products. But he learned early on that having automation and just keeping his shop small with just himself as the employee. And he would hire some part-timers because there's a lot of secondary machining. There's some mundane stuff that you got to do, you know, like deburring things or washing parts, doing those kinds of things. Sometimes the parts need to be, you know, like turned on a manual lathe just to get one end of it trued up to get, you know, to have blanks made and do. There's some things that are that are non-technical. Sorry, I just smacked my microphone there. This is a high-class operation. But there's a lot of technical things that happen there that are non-technical things, I should say, that you can hire. You know, and he would hire temps. He would go to temporary services where he didn't have to do anything. They would just, you know, he would just pay a bill to the temporary service, and they took care of all the payroll and everything else. And I think he actually did hire one person out of that for a while who was working part-time, because he got big enough at one point where he had to have somebody kind of come in and do it. Was just, they were working such a regular job, regular thing. But that gave him the opportunity to try them out before, you know, it's kind of like a try before you buy type thing. And it worked really well. He was able to hire that one person. Now, when he ended up getting married, his wife ended up being part of the business as well, and she helped do everything as well. So they kind of, within the family, they were able to expand a little bit that way and save some money and make money doing that, because they could expand what they were doing. And that was after he started doing some of his own. He actually had an invention that he what had to do with machining. It was a part for, it was an adapter part for a machine that he ended up selling aftermarket. And I think he's still selling that today. I think probably doing more. It's been a long time since I talked to him. But he experienced it very early on, keeping your company small, one-man show, or if possible. You will do much better over the long haul than you will hiring a lot of people, typically. The overhead just skyrockets. And employees don't see that end of it. They don't see that side of it. They don't see the risk that you're taking even when you take on a new employee. That employee can end up costing you a lot of money if they're unable to perform and do their job and produce. Now all the time you spend in training, in, you know, HR and all the manpower it took to get them into position, and they don't perform. That can cost you money, or they might start stealing from the company. Who knows? I had an individual over the course of about 2 years, this is an estimate, I think he took about $16,000 from my company. This is back in the 90s. At least about 16 grand was unaccounted for, and it seemed to be going into the maintenance department. And I'm pretty sure that was in his pocket. Now, it wasn't cash. It was other things. It was parts and stuff like that. He actually did pad his time card a little bit too. That was another thing we found. It was actually doing that as well. But it wasn't until I had hired another mechanic that I found those things out, or maintenance guy, I should say. So anyway, I digress. You take on all those kinds of risks, and here I was not making as much money. So I took the company down to just me again. I let everybody find their, I let everybody know the company's going to shut down. And as the company was shutting down, I started filling in and taking place of the services that we were providing there. And I started doing more of the work again that I had started doing beforehand. And I started charging a lot more for it, because I didn't really want to do at that point I wanted to close the business down. So I just started charging more for my rates, because it wasn't, you know, I found out all of a sudden that I got a whole different class of clientele when I started charging more. I got more professional individuals, and they didn't care about the cost. They just wanted somebody who was good. And of course I had all this experience, so I was good. And they would pay it. But I didn't, at that point, I was burned out on the whole industry. I didn't want to do it anymore. I had kind of moved on to something else, and I was moving on to somebody else just paying me to be the employee instead of me having to run the show. I got bit pretty hard with that, especially with taxes, payroll taxes, other things, all kinds of fees. And then the government decided they were going to estimate what I owed them. When, after I shut the company down, they said, well, you have to prove to us that you shut the company down. How do I prove that you've shut down? How do you prove you're not doing business? How do you do that? I asked them point blank in their face. I said, how do you want me to prove that I'm not doing business anymore? Well, you need to show us receipts and bank statements. I'm like, my bank account's closed, and I don't have any receipts because I'm not buying anything. They kind of looked at me funny and realized how stupid that was. I think that at least the person I was talking to realized how stupid that was. And they didn't know what to say. But now the problem is that that's not them, and I wasn't upset with them because they're just doing their job. I'm upset with the situation and the people behind this whole thing and the bureaucracy that goes along with it because it was ridiculous. And I think to this day, I think there's probably something on record that I owe somebody something for some kind of state thing. But I, it's like, how do you want me to prove that I did not do business or I didn't have payroll? You need to ask my employees. Well, I didn't have any employees. So good luck finding them. So it goes on and on and on. And this is the kind of bureaucracy that I think a lot of businesses run into. And they realize that I'm just going to keep this, how many businesses out there would be much bigger and do a lot more and employ a lot more people if the government wouldn't have such a stranglehold on the whole thing? Well, this whole thing, what I was talking about with the boat, is kind of the same way with taxes. You get to this point where you're most efficient, and in order to overcome that next hurdle of that next tax bracket, you have to work, unless you can scale the company in a linear fashion, which is not typically the case. A lot of times it takes to scale from being able to produce or provide service at X amount of hours per or widgets per month, in order to increase that or to double that widget production or that service, those service hours provided, it's going to cost you more than twice as much. It's going to cost you maybe three times as much to scale up to that. And in the process, the government thinks that because you're doing it, because you're making this investment and taking that risk, you're going to be making a lot more money. So we're going to take more money from you now. A higher percentage of funds, not just scaled up on, we're going to take 10% all the way up to, $1 million. Whether you make 10,000 or a million, you're going to pay 10%. No, it doesn't happen that way. Once you hit that $200,000 mark or whatever it is, it goes up. The percentage goes up. It's not a linear scale. It's not a fair tax, if you want to call it that. So that's what happens. And that's why a lot of business people, this is where the Tea Party movement started. Taxed enough already. T-E-A. T. That's where the Tea Party came from. Tired of the taxes. And when Obama came into office, we knew the taxes were coming. Tax and spend is what they're all about. That's what we're about to see. Now, when Biden was on the trail, out there on the trail, out on the trail, out on the campaign trail. It's a little different than the pony trail. He's out there and he's saying, people who make more than $400,000 are the ones who are going to get taxed. Now, keep this in mind. This is what the majority of, I think the average income in the United States is 50, what is it, 50 something? I should probably look this up. If I had a computer with any kind of speed, I could probably look this up. Let me just look at average. This is probably pre-pandemic income in the USA. Let's see what DuckDuckGo can come up with here with this. Okay, I'm hitting enter. It's not doing anything. It's just, I'm just seeing little circles. I'm seeing circles before my eyes. Here it comes. Here it comes, folks. This is going to be the, let's see what it says. Here it comes. It's still waiting. Still waiting. Still waiting.
Good morning. Sunday morning.
Yep, there it is. Here it comes. Average income in the United States, this is the median household income in 2019. This is pre-pandemic. $68,703. Setting a new record. This was a new record in 2019. It was 6.8% higher than in 2018. And that was a record of $64,000. In 2 years in a row, we set records with that. In 2014, it was $58,000. And it sat there for 3 years. That's amazing to me. Census Bureau also reports the median income for each family in 2019 was $86,000. So the family income was $86,000, about $20,000 more. $21,000, $22,000. So typically there's one person in a household, or this says median household income. This is per family. I see. I don't know. So they're you have to kind of play with the numbers there a little bit in terms of what they're calling household income and then family income. There's kind of some things to be weighed out there a little bit. So a little bit tricky. Now this includes everybody. This includes all families, whether you're making $400,000 a year or whatever you're making. If you're making $86,000 a year as a household, you're now our household is above that. But the highest, the high percentage of people are just barely lower than that. There's a large number of people. So you get the average, the people over that bring the average up, which is, I think most people in general that you meet on the street every day are making about 50 grand a year, 40 to 50 grand a year. That's kind of the average, Joe. Now, if you're making 15 bucks an hour, well, let's do the math on that. 15 bucks an hour, and you're working 40 hours a week. And then you're making say 50 weeks a year because you take 2 weeks off. You're making about 30 grand a year plus benefits. That's before taxes. So, and that's more in line with what I think the average worker out there probably makes, between $30,000 and $40,000 a year. And that's in most of America. Now, you cannot survive on $30,000 a year in Chicago if you're downtown, or in New York. If you're downtown New York, you can't survive on that. Right off the bat, half that's going to be just in rent. And that's if you're just living in a one-bedroom, no-closet hotel room, like a little bitty thing. It's a one-bathroom. You're living in a bathroom, basically, for that. A bathroom with a bed in it. That's what you got. And that's going to take half your wages right there, let alone food and everything else you got to pay for. So that's not going to work. You're barely making it. So the interesting side of this whole thing is my point here is in saying all of this again, as usual, I talk for half an hour with one point, and I'm going to get back to my point. Finally, I'm going to get to my point. Don't worry. I can tell all of you are hanging on the edge of your seats there. You're just like right on the edge, waiting for the point. And the point never comes because I move on to something else. Speaking of moving on to something else, I'm just kidding. The point is you have to work a whole lot harder just to make a little bit more money. And then the government wants to step up and take more from you at the same time. Now, I've heard it said a lot of times, well, rich people just keep getting richer. Well, have you ever stopped and just taken a step back and asked yourself why? Because if somebody who has money probably made that money, what's the guy's name? The big financial guy. Everybody, I want to say Dave. What is his name? Dave? What is his name? It's not Dave. What is his name? It is Dave. Dave Ramsey. It just came to me. I was trying to look. I was clicking on some stuff here. Of course, my computer. I'm faster than my computer is today. That's a scary thought. Or at least I'm faster than the internet. The computer's faster than me. Information getting to the computer is not very fast. Dave Ramsey, they did a huge amount of studies on people, statistics about things about how people make their money. The vast majority of people who are millionaires made their money. They did not inherit it. I think it's only like 9 or 12% somewhere. It's really down. It's close to the 10% mark, I think, of people who are millionaires that actually inherited their money. Now, having said that, I've in past life, I was flying corporately, and I flew people around who were well, let's just say they're well-to-do families. They owned the airplanes that I was flying around. And most of them, many of them, if not all of them, the further you were removed from the patriarch or the matriarch or whoever it was that made the money, the person who actually ran, you know, the company that started the company that grew up into the monstrosity that it was, and it, you know, sold out or got, you know, stock options or whatever they got, whatever they were living on. If they managed it properly, they got, you know, they still had a lot of money out there that was making them money. Their money was making them money. And you get to this point where you have, then you have the kids. So this, you got the originator, then you have their kids. Usually, you know, two or three, whatever, maybe four, but two or three, typically, who didn't start off from their bootstraps and work hard and start from nothing and built the company up. They didn't do that. They inherited the company. Typically, one or two of them will have some business sense and be able to continue to handle their and manage the finances well and continue the company going forward. By the time you get to the grandkids, now you're starting to have problems. Chances are they have never known struggle in terms of financial issues. They've never had to start something from scratch and tried to pay bills, or they've never had their electricity disconnected or their phone bill disconnected. Phone bill disconnected or just their phone disconnected because they couldn't pay their bill. They've never been concerned about making it through a week without food. They've never known that kind of thing. And there's something about that that develops a character. That if you can make it through those times and be honest with yourself and with your neighbor, and you can work your way out of that, it does something to you internally that you can't explain any other way. But then it gets to the kids, and the kids' kids, and then you get to the great-grandkids. And oh my goodness, they are usually, let's just put it this way, a high percentage of them are very messed up. They've got money to do whatever they want. They fly around on a jet airplane. I'm not saying they're all this way. Don't get me wrong. Because there are some very intelligent, fine, very disciplined individuals. And this is something that really impresses me. People don't talk about this, but this really impresses me about Trump. Now, their kids have some issues. Don't get me wrong. I'm sure they're human. I'm sure they've got issues. But look at his kids. They have all pretty much grown up to be fairly successful individuals. Now everybody says, oh, that's just because they're rich kids. Yeah, they've got everything they want. No. I don't know how things are messed. I don't know how messed up things are in their family. I don't know. Maybe they are really messed up. I don't know. But you want to put Joe Biden's kids up alongside Trump's kids and see what we have here in terms of productivity, drug addiction, children out of wedlock, crimes that have been committed. You want to do that? You want to play that game? That's pretty impressive, folks. That's pretty dang impressive. I've been around a lot of people who've had some money. Not a lot, just some people who've had some money. I guess, I don't know, whatever. I've seen it up close and personal. And it takes a certain kind of character to handle that kind of those kinds of funds. And so when people start to talk bad about rich people,
you got all that money, you're not going to give it any of it away.
Well, no, they're not. Why should they? You know, you're going to go to work for them, and then you agree to work for them at a certain price. Now, don't get me wrong, there are some legitimate gripes that some people have in their companies. You see the company spend money on stupid things, and then turn around and tell you they can't afford to give you a raise. That's frustrating. But that's all I'm here. I'm not here defending the rich, okay? Because there are stupid rich people who are jerks, and there's smart people who are jerks, who are rich people as well. But you know what? There are just as many jerks and stupid people who aren't rich. Probably more, because there's more people who aren't rich. But it's one of those things where you hear this kind of thing, and it gets really old, because you're vilifying someone because they've been successful. And that's just stupid to me. Instead of acknowledging the fact that we live in a country where even stupid jerks can make money and get ahead in this world, and you know, and so that means even you have a chance.
Well, you can't make money if you're honest.
Okay, whatever. That's what you think. See how that works out for you. You know, perseverance is probably one of the biggest traits and the biggest character issues that we are not inspiring in our young people today. I tried and I failed, so I'm done. Well, I didn't even try. You know, I'm just waiting for something to drop on my lap. Now, I have worked with some of these individuals. Let me tell you. They have this entitlement mentality. Oh, I shouldn't be where I'm at. I'm so much more above this job. Well, I don't know why I'm even still here. Something needs to happen. I want to be one of those guys that just, you know, a big investor guy. Can walk around and give, you know, invest in other businesses. I want to be that guy. Okay, well, if you start saving now, if you start making some money, you can start investing in some small things. And then you can turn those investments around, learn a little bit about investments. You know, even if it's just a scale of $1,000, invest in some micro company, you know, micro investment in somebody's business, crowdfunding. Get started doing something.
Oh, I want to be big. I want to invest $1 million.
Okay. Well, good luck with that. I just tried to help you get there step by step and just tried to give you some, you know, because this is like somebody who wants to own a restaurant, who's looking for $1 million to invest in a restaurant, who's never even worked at McDonald's, never had any kind of food service experience whatsoever. And you want somebody to just loan you the money for that. Yeah, that's not going to happen. And anybody who does is an idiot, because they're not going to see their investment. Probably not going to see their money back from that. Unless you can show me on a business plan the people you're hiring, the people you're taking in, that somehow have the skills to get you from point A to point B, which, you know, of course, they don't even want to fill out a business plan because, no, I just want the money. I know I can make it work. I know it can work. This is a good business. I know I can do this. Okay, well, then good luck with that. Don't ask me for anything, because I want to see how you're going to pay me back. I want to see how your investment, I want to see how you're going to be successful. You know, even if you can't pay me back, even if I lose money in this venture, which I'm willing to do, obviously, because I'm willing to invest in a business, I'm not looking for a guarantee outcome. But I would love to see the business succeed. And that's kind of the point. I'm at that point in my life now where I've got a lot of great ideas for businesses, but I think I'm at a point where I don't really want to start the business. I want to invest in somebody else who has the energy to do it and let them, you know, but I don't want to just give it to them either. I want to see them earn it and cut their teeth and be able to really, you know, develop the things that I had to develop, because it was good for me. For the most part, it was a little traumatic, but you know, I look like 100. I'm 120 years old, and I'm only half that. But it's, you know, because of the stress. And yeah, there were nights. Literally, there were many nights for years. I would lay awake at night, wondering when the guys with the IRS was going to come in and bust in and take me away. I really thought they were going to do that. I worried about that stuff. And I still do. I think, but now I think it's going to be the guys with the little white coats and the net. They're going to come and take me away. If they ever listen to this podcast, they're probably going to be right outside. They're probably outside the door right now. So I'm trying to figure out a way to do this. This whole talk today has gone down a road I was not expecting. I have to tell you. Of course, I didn't have my notes in front of me, which I usually don't anyway. If you saw my notes for the show notes for this, the show prep I have is, you know, there's a lot of guys who have show prep. They pay for it. They like, I don't know how you have to like fill out a bunch of stuff. This is what my show is about. These are the kind of topics I want to talk about. They present you with this stack of show prep. They just give it to you every day. However many times, you know, if your show is every day, they give you this show prep every day. This is the current news. It's what's going on. Now, I'll go through headlines once in a while. It's kind of interesting because, you know, it's interesting stuff. I'll go through headlines. Like, let's take a look here. Like this one right here. I'll pull this up and see if I'll get it over here on the screen where I can read it. New York woman contracts COVID a month after getting the vaccine. Well, that's because it doesn't have a 100% success rate. We know this going in, folks. It's like between 80 and 90% for most of them. So there is a 10 to 20% chance you were going to get COVID. Duh. This is not, but we've now reduced in the population itself. We've reduced of a million people. We now are only going to have maybe, you know, what is it, 200,000 who could potentially get it if a million people are vaccinated. Instead of a million, it's down to 200,000. We've now cut down the number of people who can get it. And keep in mind, this is a disease that has a 99.95% survivability rate among the general population. Everybody from, you know, 0 to 110. And yeah, there's people who are over 100 years old who've survived this thing. So let's just realize that it's getting to the point where it's about like the common cold. It's more deadly than that, but however, people have died from the common cold as well. So let's not, you know, go too crazy with this. Let's keep our heads about ourselves and look at the actual science. Now, therapeutics have helped. And I think therapeutics are probably as important, if not more in some cases, in being able to overcome this thing. You know, understanding how to treat this, if you catch it, I think is incredibly important at this point. You know, early detection, early treatment, getting on top of it right away, I think is a very important part of this, of beating this thing. More important, in my opinion, than the masks. So that's where I'm at with that. AOC doesn't like the word surge. Says it's, guess what? White supremacist thinking. A surge is white supremacist thinking. And anything, let's talk about that for a second. I don't have a whole lot of time left in this show, but when everything becomes racist and in the whole, and racist is now part of being white supremacist and a Nazi, all those things are now kind of just combined into one bucket. Let's back away from that just for a second. Can we? It's just getting really old. When everything is racist. Everything is racist. It's this thing of, I think I'm going to have to write a show. I'm going to call the, you know, I haven't seen the TNA to me singers in here for a long time. I'll have to see how they, to call them over to see if they want to do a song about that. Well, I might do a spoof on the Everything is Awesome song. Just everything is racist. Because now it's not just an issue of racial discrimination or bigotry or profiling, but just that's different. In fact, I would say racial discrimination is even different than racism or white supremacy or black supremacy. Racial supremacy, I'm going to call it that. Because it's not one person. If you can be judgmental about the way a person looks. You can not want to associate with them because of the way they look. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you think you're superior to them. It doesn't necessarily mean that. It might. Now you can argue deeply on the philosophy of how a way person thinks and all the things that are happening. And then there's the whole systemic racism and the racist. Our constitution is racist. Our flag is racist. Everything about our country is terrible and racist. So we want to invite more brown people here into this racist nation. Why are they fighting, clawing, dying, trying to get in across our border because we're such a terrible country? That just continues to just really bother me when they continue to vilify our country so much, and they want to allow anybody who wants to come here, just come here. I see we keep calling them migrants. Folks, migrants are people who come here, apply for citizenship, and they migrate here. They are immigrants, come from another country. They apply for citizenship. We allow over 1 million people a year to do that. Our borders are not closed. Immigration is not closed. We did close immigration here, I think back in the 70s or something, 60s or 70s. It was actually closed for several years. We weren't letting in new immigrants. And I'm not talking about people coming across the border. I'm talking about people who are allowed to come here legally. We shut down immigration for a few years. Immigration and people crashing the border are two different things. And they would like for you to think that they are the same. They are one and the same. Illegal border crossers and people who come across legally, either with work permits or apply for citizenship, 1 million a year apply for citizenship and are granted citizenship every year. Every year. Like 1.1 or 1.2 million people. And yet that's not enough. We want to have anybody who comes across the border, once they set foot on the border, by golly, we're going to take you in. And we're encouraging them to do so, which is absolutely insane. We don't know who they are. We don't know where they're going. Turning them loose without a court date, turning them loose without any kind of information, whether or not we know whether or not they even have COVID or not. So a lot of people are not even being tested. Now, these are the people we are catching coming across the border. How many are getting across the border that are not being apprehended? Because you have, just like recently, we had a couple of coyotes drove trucks through the fence that was cut down. This is part of the fence, not part of the wall. Came flying down through an intersection and got hit by a truck, and there was like 20 people, or 19 or 20 people in a Suburban. I'm sure they were rushing them right over to Border Patrol. How many more of those? If they would not have been hit, we would have never heard about it. Never would have heard about it. The second truck, we didn't hear about that one. It got away. There were two trucks. Teachers heading to the border to instruct illegals as many U.S. schools remain closed. It's because we can't have those young individuals coming across here and not having any school education. They were able to survive them on their own, walking 2,000 miles by themselves with nothing but a little backpack with a sandwich. But they, by golly, we better give them school because our kids can go without for a little while. Vice President Carmela, called out for laughing at serious questions. Folks, this is the way she is. Every question, every serious question she's ever been given, she sidesteps. She's very good at that. She's extremely talented, by the way, at doing that. Sometimes she gives you an answer that sounds like an answer. It's not an answer. She'll say, well, I think that's a conversation we need to have. That's what we're trying to have. She'll use that a lot. She'll say, well, I think that's a conversation we need to have. That's what we're trying to have here is a conversation, and you're not participating in it. All you're saying is we need to have a conversation. When's the conversation going to happen? Or because we're asking you now. This is the conversation. This is the time for that conversation. Let's have it. Let's have your answers on it and see where you stand. No, I don't want to say where I stand on anything. Biden's dog bites another White House staffer. Okay, there's this little thing called a harbinger, and it's been it's interesting that this kind of stuff happens. One of Biden's two dogs bit someone at the White House. They were not allowed back at the White House again. Now, I'm not sure how. Apparently, the dogs made it back to the White House again. Apparently, there's a problem with the control that they have over these dogs. Now, having said that, it's interesting that Biden's dogs. Not only did he get hurt, supposedly, pulling one of the dog's tails. He fell down and hurt his foot or something. I don't know what happened. I wasn't there. I'm glad I wasn't because he was getting out of the shower. That would have been ugly. So I didn't. He didn't. You know, this whole thing of his dogs seemed to kind of keep popping up in the news. And they keep biting Secret Service and White House staff. So, you know, the question is, what is this telling us? Sometimes I think God speaks through events like this. If we're willing, this is what I think. And I think God's been kind of telling me this a lot in the last, I'm going to get really personal about this for a second. I think that things happen to us a lot of times. I think that God, some people want to hear from God. I want to get a word from God. I want to try so hard to hear what he's saying to me. I guarantee you that God is trying to speak to you a million times more to you. Yes, you, as mundane as and little as you think you are. The God of the universe that created the stars that dwarf the size of our solar system wants to speak to you individually as a person, a million times more than you want to try to hear him. I guarantee you. I can say that with full confidence, knowing that I'm going to stand before God someday, and he's going to ask me why I said that. Because it's true. In fact, a million probably is not a large enough number. I don't know that there is a large enough number. A trillion is probably not large enough either. And I think that there's these little things that happen throughout the day. There's nothing, God is so involved in the details of our lives that we have no clue. We have no idea. And so many times we're just ignorant and stubborn of his ways and the way he works and what he's trying to say to us. And I think that there's those little things that happen, and not just the good things that happen. And not just, oh, look, I found a $20 bill. Oh, well, praise God. No, praise money. You're now all of a sudden you're only seeing the blessing of God and when you get money, which means that to me that means money is your God. Now I'm not saying God can't bless us by giving us money. I'm not saying that at all, but it seems like the only time I see some people praising God and saying they've been blessed is when they have something financially. And folks, I see a lot of financial folks out there who have a lot of money who are evil. So don't tell me that money is the metric that we need to gauge our blessing from God. That's at that point now money is your God. Now, can God bless us with money? Absolutely. That's a whole thing. I'm not going to get into it. But the little things that happen, drop a piece of paper on the floor. It's a receipt from Walmart. What's on the receipt? It's just little things like that that I think happen to us. And I think that that's, without going into that with any further detail, I think sometimes those things have a way of speaking something, that God's trying to say something to us or get our attention about something. And I think that that's the case here with Joe's dogs. In fact, I think that Joe tripping up the steps three times, each time worse than the first, or worse than the last, I think that's a significant thing. I think that all those things kind of have a tendency to be a message. Something is trying to be spoken to us. Now, how we interpret it is we need to treat very carefully. It's very easy for us to jump to a conclusion. So we need to very open-handedly receive those things and kind of look at those things. But that's just my opinion. Okay, so I'll just move on from there, because that's now I'm going down a rabbit hole, and I have another 2-hour show I'd have to do for that. For the first time in history, churchgoers are a minority in the U.S. according to this study. Now I don't know that to be true or not. I always kind of wonder about that stuff, because how do you gauge churchgoers, and who are they asking? These are like the political polls. I don't trust them that much. Very possible. I don't know. But, you know, people do a lot of online church stuff now. So are they churchgoers? Because you're watching something online. DOJ, anti-Trump witch hunt lands super spy 12 years in jail. 12-year jail sentence. I saw a headline, and this is not in this thing, but apparently Barr had an investigation against Gates, I guess, right near the end of Barr's time as the AG. And Gates is under fire for some stuff, and it's obvious. This is obviously a smear job and an investigation of some kind that's going on behind the scenes, and I'm not sure what all that's about, but he's coming out flailing. He's coming out swinging. He is not going to put up with this, and I don't blame him. And this comes back to the whole thing of what is going on with the DOJ. It seems like that the FBI and the DOJ seems like all they do is find dirt on people that they can use to manipulate them. Gates is a very outspoken individual when it comes to stuff that's going on in Congress. I think he was an outspoken Trump supporter, which means that they're going to come after him. World leaders call for pandemic, quote, pandemic treaty, but they release few details on what it would mean, what it would do. This kind of goes along with the whole the passport thing we're talking about, the vaccine passport they're talking about. You can download this app. Now talk about limiting people's abilities. I mean, this is where poor people, not a lot of people, don't get me wrong, a lot of poor people have phones, smartphones. And but they can't get an ID because they, you know, so they can vote, because that's voter suppression. But you can get an app for your phone so you can travel. So you can go to do things. And Governor DeSantis down in Florida has gone out against this, you know, big time. He's gonna try to push back on this and make it illegal in the state of Florida. He thinks it's unconstitutional. I do as well. There's huge issues here with this, and I think that it needs to be nipped in the bud. Now, whether or not other countries can do it or not, and then that limits you to international travel. There's all kinds of things where this could be, you know, there could be some ramifications for people who have to travel for business, those kinds of things. So that's going to be difficult to navigate all that world. And so it'll be, I'm not sure if that's what this pandemic treaty thing is about. It's that sounds kind of ambiguous. I'm not sure what it's about. So I'm not going to click on the article. I'm not going to read it. So I'm just going to read the headline. WAPO gives Joe Biden, Washington Post, by the way, that's WAPO, quote, 4 Pinocchios for his false claim about Georgia voting law. Well, good for them. I hope they go after some pundits who have said some things too, Chris Wallace. MSNBC's Joe Scarborough, who has a total hack job, guys. He's never been a Republican. He ran as a Republican. I think he was actually in the Congress as a Republican, but he's The guy is not a Republican. MSNBC's Joe Scarborough assumes Senator Duckworth is an immigrant. She's not. Biden's massive infrastructure bill doesn't include infrastructure. This is so typical.
Oh, we got roads and bridges. Let's pass this bill. It has nothing to do with roads and bridges. This is so typical. Hopefully we get to call them out on this. Oh, this is not good. I did not see this headline before. G. Gordon Liddy has apparently died at the age of 90. Now, for those of you who don't understand who G. Gordon Liddy is, G. Gordon Liddy was a part of the Nixon administration. He was part of the Republican Party back when Nixon was in charge. I think he was actually part of the GOP. I don't know how he was connected in terms of what his job description was or what his actual position was there. All I know is he was one of the guys. I think he may have actually been one of the, he physically was one of the guys who broke into the file cabinet at the Watergate Hotel. I believe. They were trying to get information on the opposition, on the DNC opposition. And of course, he would have gone to jail probably for doing that. It was a bit of a misdemeanor. However, he ended up, the cover-up is what ended up being the real problem with Watergate. Nixon supposedly didn't know anything about it until, you know, when he did find out about it, he tried to cover it up. That was where the problem was. G. Gordon Liddy was in the middle of all that. And I believe G. Gordon Liddy got a pardon from President Nixon prior to Nixon resigning, the way I understand. Now, it may have been President Ford. I don't know. Somebody there pardoned G. Gordon Liddy. G. Gordon Liddy had a huge turnaround and came out of all of that as a talk show. He basically started his own radio show and was very popular. And in my opinion, huge transformation. Chuck Colson was another guy who also, I think it was Chuck Colson and G. Gordon Liddy actually may have been the guys. But now Chuck spent some time in prison, I believe, possibly. I'm not positive about that or not. But he did start a prison ministry out of that, that was huge. And he was a genuine, he came to Christ through all of that. He has a huge testimony. Now, speaking of that, let's talk about this. There's two other things here. Alabama governor reaffirms end to the mask mandate. In other words, he's doubling down. He's not listening to JoJo. And Britain's Queen Elizabeth is returning to her public duties after COVID restrictions are eased. Let's get back to this whole thing about testimonies, people having a come to faith moment. And this happens occasionally. I think even, what's her name, Paris Hilton. I think she actually went to jail for a while and she actually started walking around with the Bible and telling everybody she was becoming Christian. Now, this is all well and good. I thank God it happens. And sometimes it's genuine. Alice Cooper is an individual who actually did come to Christ. I'm not going to judge how he walks or what he does. I'm just saying he had a real, I think he had a genuine experience. Now, having said that, supposedly Barack Obama was raised a Muslim. Supposedly Barack Obama became a Christian. I have never heard of his testimony. When you go from being a Muslim to being a Christian, this is a huge transformation and a huge testimony. In all the books he has written, which he didn't actually write, all the stories about him, all of the biographies and things that people have asked him about, never once have I heard a testimony of his conversion. I don't know that he's ever been baptized. All I know is he started going to the Reverend Wright's church in Chicago. And Muslims attend there. They welcome Muslims there. They don't ask you to. You can be a member of the church and be a Muslim there. That's my understanding of it. I could be way off on that. I could be way wrong. But my understanding is
that is the case. And attending a church, Christian church or not, attending the church does not make you a Christian or a believer in Messiah any more than going to McDonald's makes you a cheeseburger. So, having said all of that, now, granted, I also have not heard President Trump's testimony. All I know is that everything he did, all of the legislation he signed, all of the things he pushed for, were certainly in line and friendly, legislatively, policy-wise, to not just Christian churches, but religion in general in the country, in terms of religious liberties. Huge issues. But especially in contrast to what we experienced in the 8 years prior, the Christian church was able to participate in those liberties as well. All of a sudden, it wasn't evil in terms of the administration to be a Christian, instead of the people with guns and religion or whatever it was. I don't kind of remember. Angry, bitter clingers clinging to their guns and their Bibles. Bitter clingers. That's what we are. Those people out here in the middle of the country are bitter clingers. So whenever I hear about these conversion experiences or people who have faith, all of a sudden this newfound faith that they have, I want to hear their story. I want to hear this experience that they had, this conversion experience that they had. And maybe it's just a mental decision that they made. That's fine. That's whatever they want to call it. Some people have had an experience with, you know, in the presence of God. Not that they've seen him necessarily. I know people have, there's people who've said they've seen him. I don't know. I think maybe they had a vision or had a, you know, a whatever. I guess it could happen. I'm not going to say it couldn't happen because it happened to the disciples. They saw Jesus after he had risen from the dead. But I want to hear a testimony. I want to hear, because that's the one thing that Scripture says we have that we can share, and be prepared in season and out to share, to give a testimony of the things that he's done for you. So it's that baseline thing that we all have in common as believers in Messiah, in Christ, in his saving power that connects us all. And whether or not you have that genuine experience of having a conversion experience, I think that's important. I think that's at the foundation of our belief, of what binds us together. It's what makes us a part of the church. That's where you receive membership into the church, not just become a Baptist or become a Mennonite or Catholic. It's that face-to-face encounter with the truth and who you are. So that's what I'm going to leave you with, I guess, today. I've gone way over time. This is going to take about 10 hours for this to upload today. So I apologize for that. This morning show has now gone into the afternoon. And well into the afternoon. It's like 12:38 now on Wednesday morning. Most of the things I've probably talked about probably have already been, are being discussed right now. It's almost like I provide them with show prep before they've even heard my show. It's amazing to me how many of them say the same things that I'll talk about. And I don't know if that's the control of the narrative, if I'm actually being that much controlled or not, but we'll get into that later. But so I leave you with this, and I bid you adieu. Hope you have a fine rest of your week. Hopefully tomorrow morning I may not be able to do a show. I'll try to do another one tonight. It may be a late night show, but tomorrow I'll be traveling. Tomorrow afternoon I will definitely have a chance to do a show, so I will do that. And the rest of you, God bless. Have a great day.